specializing, as opposed to everyone having to be all a kind of generalist. We can never develop anything particularly if we all have to do everything all the time. Aggregarian worlds tend not to be as sophisticated or specialized as one that has an urban center. Universities are founded, Paris and Cambridge. Romanesque and then Gothic architecture develop. Huge, stunning, complex spaces are enclosed and controlled by the hand of the architect. Vernacular literature develops, that is, non-Latin and non-Greek literature develop. And the power of secular rulers is on the rise. That one's really important. The power of non-religious rulers and leaders is on the rise. Now, the musical innovations of the High Middle Ages are many, and they are profound. First and foremost, polyphony. That is, multi-melodied compositions. Now, think back on that plain chant, that introit from the Mass of Christmas Day, Mass for Christmas Day, for a second. We heard one melody and one melody only. We heard no accompaniment. We heard no instruments. We didn't hear any other voices adding separate pitches. At any given time, there was only one melody, despite the fact that it might have been sung by 3, 5, or 10 different people. One melody. We call such music monophonic. Mono meaning one, phony meaning sound. A monophonic texture is one in which there is only one present melody. Look, we can all create monophony wherever we are. Just start singing now. I don't know, whatever comes to mind, Indigata Divita, whatever hits your head. That is a monophonic texture. Unaccompanied, no other melodic lines interweaving within yours. Now, one of the most extraordinary musical inventions of the High Middle Ages is polyphony, polyphony, multiple melodies present at the same given moment. These multiple melodied compositions at first employed plain chants, and we're going to hear an example of such a composition in a minute. That is, you'd have a plain chant, a Gregorian chant in one voice, and then it would be decorated and embellished simultaneously in another, creating the effect of two simultaneous and different melodies. It is during the High Middle Ages that the concept of composer and performer develops. That is, that these are separate people. One person writes the music, and one person performs the music. And we should probably add a third element, because if you've got a composer and a performer, you hopefully have an audience. That is, someone whose only job it is to passively listen to the music. I would point out that an increasingly complex world demands increasingly complex modes of expression. So we shouldn't be surprised by these evolutions. Now, the music of the High Middle Ages that I will play for you, and again, a 400-year chunk, offers us an extraordinary amount of repertoire, which I must limit to two pieces. The music I will play for us is very representative of its time and comes, in both cases, from Paris. The art of polyphony from the 12th century, that is, from the 1100s, until the late 14th century, the late 1300s, developed primarily in northern France, with Paris at the center, and radiated outwards to Europe from there. The first composer that we feel comfortable calling a composer, that is, someone whose music is signed and someone who we know created this work and that work, is a gentleman named Léonin, who was born about the year 1135 and died, for sure, in 1201. He's one of the great church poet composers of his age, and he worked out of the New Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Following the footsteps of previous composers, he raises the art of polyphony to a new level. And the following musical example combines something new, something old, and something very new. In the music of Léonin's time, the late 1100s and early 1200s, it was not atypical to combine all kinds of different styles within a single piece of music. We're going to listen to a piece of music called Alleluia Pascha Nostrum, Hallelujah, Our Passover, and then Gaudeat Devotio Fidelium, Let the Devotion of the Faithful Be Raised in Rejoicing. And we will hear these pieces performed as a singularity, as a continuity. Here's what we're going to hear. Three parts, something old, something new, something very new. Part one is new. It is what Leonin is a master of, florid organum. All right, organum is that sort of musical composition that puts a plain chant in a lower voice, usually sustained in very long notes, and then in an upper voice, a very fast embellishment of that plain chant. So we hear the long-held notes in the bass, and then the faster notes up top. Actually, I shouldn't call it a bass. I should call it by its proper term. The low voice with the sustained notes was called the tenor voice. And that comes from the Italian, or I should say the Latin, tenere, which means to hold or sustain. They were the sustaining voice, and that's where the phrase, the word tenor, comes from. This florid organum, this upper voice, very flowery, is typical of what we call the Notre Dame school of the 12th century, and Leonin is its greatest exponent. So that's something new, this very flowery embellishment of a long-held plain chant. The second part is something old. For a moment, we're going to hear a bit of plain chant without any polyphony, without any accompaniment whatsoever, followed by another little bit of organum. And I'll point that out when we hear it. I'll say part two. That's the old stuff. Part three is very new, cutting edge, modernistic, avant-garde, out there. What we're going to hear is a section of religious music which has a dance-like feel to it. It's what we call the descant style, and that means the lower voices are going to move with the same dancing rhythms as the upper voice, and it's going to be very physical music, very powerful music, and very new-sounding music, and these are the words that they're going to be singing. Let the devotion of the faithful be raised. This is part three. In rejoicing, the word of the Father is made flesh, and a new child is given to us, and he has bestowed himself upon us. The salvation of the people has opened the gateway of life, for he in devotion has borne the punishment of death. So again, part one, florid organum, all they're going to be singing is Hallelujah, our Passover. Part two, a brief bit of old-style plain chant, followed by a little more organum, and then part three, this long poem in rhythms that are frankly more dance-like than they are prayer-like or contemplative. While listening, please ask yourself this following question. Is this music, like plain chant, generic, egoless music of ritual, or does this music have the spark of originality and ego in it? Part two. Part three.
Verbum patris in tu notur nova.
So, is this anonymous, generic music of ritual? Well, heck no. I mean, it moves, it grooves, it's got all kinds of contrast, changing sections in there, and someone's got to make all these decisions. Someone's got to decide what notes we're going to hear at the same time, when one section will end and the next one begin, the degree of contrast, the sense of flow. We've got to have a composer, someone making a tremendous number of melodic, harmonic, rhythmic and structural decisions, and having made them, that composer has to have the means by which to notate them, write them down, and give them to expert performers capable of performing that music. We've got a whole hierarchy here, and indeed we have the evolution of a notational system capable of notating that last example, which is very engaged and, in its own way, very complicated music. What is this music expressive of? Well, it's still religious, but compared to the plain chant, it's much more melodically diverse, rhythmically interesting, intellectual, and personalized in its impact. It reflects a much broader, more complex world and a broader worldview. The composer's name is Leonin, Master Leonin to us, Lionheart to history. Now, please, I'm going to take a quick departure here because I have to bring something up. I'm crazy about the music of the High Middle Ages, and I'm going to play you some more examples before we end our investigation of the High Middle Ages. But some would tell us that this differentiation between composer, performer, and audience was heresy, that it destroyed Western music forever. And you know what? They could make a very good argument. They would say that because of the High Middle Ages, because of the intrusion of ego into the soul of the performer and composer, music ceased to be the communal and shared activity that would bring us all together, and simply started to be an activity that created a new ritual. You sit still and be quiet while I sing to you what they created for me to perform for you. This whole hierarchy takes away the communal music making, and it's true. And here in the 20th century, of course, we've advanced this ritual to a point almost past which we should not go. For example, let's talk about opera. You stand outside an opera house, and people are dressed the same way. We have a listening ritual, do we not? We dress up in our coat and our tie and our suits, because if we're not properly dressed at the opera house, we're not showing respect. And we go down there and we sit and we do our thing. Listen, and this is a purely personal view of the world. I come from an informal generation and I wear my informality on my sleeve. I've always felt that ties were the whalebone corsets of the neck, something throttling and reducing the oxygen flow to my brain, that a jacket is kind of like a smelting oven for the body, something to raise my body temperature past a point of any degree of comfort. So I don't generally like to dress up when I do anything. Now, someone might tell me that's showing disrespect for the singers and for the opera. But, of course, the singers couldn't care less what I was wearing. Frankly, we would do a whole lot of good in this country by telling everyone to come to the opera dressed down, if you want to, if you want to. Some people bemoan the lack of formality in our world today, but I say, hey, be comfortable first. The singers don't know what we're wearing. They can't see us at all. The lights are in their eyes. If we want to show respect for the singers, here's what we do. We sit quietly during a performance. We honor them properly by applauding and hooting at the proper moments. And when the opera ends, we don't rush out to our cars with the fear that we're going to get online at the garage and get stuck for an extra 10 minutes. No, we stay in our seats and we applaud the good work of the performers and the composer, whether the composer is alive or dead. Oh, my friends, there's nothing worse than jumping out of your seat during that initial round of applause and running to the car in the fear that it's going to be two or three more minutes and the applause will take too much time. Oh, no. If we want to show respect, It has nothing to do with our mode of dress. It has to do with our mode of behavior and response to what we've heard. What is expressive in this music of the High Middle Ages? It is religious, but it also exhibits an individual vision. It exhibits a complex series of musical events put together by the whim of the composer. When we reconvene for Lecture 4, we will continue talking about the High Middle Ages, and we will continue exploring this ongoing development of expressive content as we move inevitably into the Renaissance and then the invention of opera. Thank you very much. Welcome back to How to Understand and Listen to Opera. This is Lecture 4, and we continue our all-too-brief history of vocal expression in Western music as we pave our way forward to the invention of opera. We left off during the High Middle Ages, and that is where we will pick up again here in Lecture 4. We just listened to a piece by Leonin, one of the first composers who actually wrote his name on works and took credit as composer for that music that he produced. It's music that reflects an increasingly complex time in increasingly complex musical means. It's music that in its own way is quite expressive and very different from the more generic plain chants that had preceded the High Middle Ages during the Dark Ages. Now, the High Middle Ages, that era from about 1000 to 1400, also saw an explosion of secular, that means non-religious music, as royal courts and aristocratic classes grew tremendously. Pop music, my friends, has always existed. But until the High Middle Ages, popular music was, one, an oral, not a notated tradition, and two, the creators of popular music up to the High Middle Ages were anonymous, itinerant, low-life musicians, oh, there's a self-canceling phrase, if you will, who traveled the countryside earning a few copper coins for their trouble. But by the time we get to the High Middle Ages, these pop composers are also becoming known. Their music is becoming notated, and we know who they were. For example, one of the most famous musicians of the 12th century was Bernard de Ventadorn, who lived a very brief life from about 1150 to 1180. He is one of the best-known troubadours of the 12th century. And one of his best preserved songs is a song named Quand veille la lazzarda mouvere, when I see the lark beating its wings. So let's listen and talk about this piece as an illustration of the beginnings of a popular musical culture during an age that increasingly celebrates things non-religious. By the way, the words of this song are in the language Provençal. Provençal is that language now unused of medieval southern France. The song is a lover's complaint. I would point out that lover's complaints comprise the main body of the entire repertoire of these courtly love songs, which is one. Lover's complaints also comprise the main body of torch songs, of tearjerkers, and probably 98% of all country and western are lover's complaints. What's that wonderful and terrible joke I once heard about C&W music, that if you play a country and western song backwards, it says, my girl is back, the truck is running, and the dog is alive? Lover's complaint stuff. Anyway, the words to Ventadorn's Quand veille la lazzarda mouvere, when I see the lark beating its wings joyfully against the sun's rays, which then swoons and swoops down because of joy in its heart. Oh, I feel such jealousy for all those who have the joy of love that I am astonished that my heart does not immediately melt with desire. Alas, I thought I knew so much of love, and I know so little, for I cannot help loving a lady from whom I shall never obtain any favor. She has taken away my heart and myself and herself and the whole world, and when she left me, I had nothing left but desire and a yearning heart. Let's listen, please, and I would point out the following two things that I want you to listen for. In this performance, the song will be unaccompanied, as a troubadour might sing it in any company at any place. And secondly, while listening, ask yourself, what is this song expressive of? Bernard de Ventadorn's Can Vey la Lalceta Ouvert.
Can Vey la Lalceta Mover De joyous assalas contra al rai Que s'oblides la estata zer Per la dosur cal cor mi va Ai, tan grandsen vehamen ve, de cui que io veia jausium. Meravilia sai car de se, le cor de desirer non fu. Ai last an quidava saber d'amor et an petit ensai, car eu d'amar non posc tener, se lescon già prum non aurai. Tot m'amo corre, tot m'amme, e se mese se tut l'omun, e cansem tolc nom laeset re, mas desirere car volum.
It's very beautiful, and for those who can hit a rewind button, I would suggest you rewind and re-listen to this again right away. Without harmonic accompaniment, the melody is harder to follow than if there had been an accompaniment, but it's an exquisitely beautiful melody, carefully wrought, and most descriptive, I think, of the mood that Ventadorn is trying to create. I asked, what was this expressive of? Well, it attempts to express, with admittedly simple but I think exquisite means, individual heartbreak, the pain of a single person's feeling at having been left behind by love. There's nothing generic in this song any more than there was anything generic in the Mahler song from The Wayfarer that we heard way back earlier in the course, which was about the same thing, about a broken heart in the face of love. Nature is celebrated for all its joy and beauty, but that's a joy and beauty that I don't have in my own soul. These two songs are very much alike, different traditions, different times, but the same impulse. There's nothing generic about this piece. It deals with common human feelings, if a bit prettified and idealized. Now we move into the 14th century, or what the Italians call the Trecento. Some people call this the Middle Ages, and some people call the 14th century just the 14th century, because it stands alone in the history of Western Europe for many reasons, which I will now go through. Look, most importantly, the 14th century sees the end of the absolute authority of the Roman Christian Church. And this end to its power and authority, not a complete end to its power, the Roman Church is still a most powerful institution, but the end to its absolute authority came about for a number of different reasons, and I would quickly go through them right now. Between 1305 and 1378, we see something that is now called the Babylonian captivity. Due to huge municipal unrest in Rome, the entire papal court, and please remember that the Pope was not just a religious leader back in these days, the Pope was a monarch controlling huge swatches of land and a great amount of financial resource. So the Pope was not just a spiritual leader, but the Pope was also an earthly leader of tremendous power and influence. Due to the problems in Rome, the entire papal court ups and leaves to Avignon in southern France. This is a problem because Rome is supposedly the great European city of Catholicism, and by 1378, those still in Italy are tired of the Pope ruling from France. So from 1378 to 1417, we have what's called the Great Schism. two and even sometimes three rival claimants to the papacy simultaneously. Now, do you see what this does to the whole Catholic hierarchy? The concept of the papacy is that the Pope is God's representative on earth. And, of course, Catholicism is a single God religion. I mean, there's only one great God, and the Pope is the God's voice on earth. What happens when you have two popes? Three popes? Well, which is the real one? Which one really represents God? Because they're all going to say, it's me, it's me. Yeah, this is a huge blow to the faith that's necessary to sustain belief in this particular religious system. Increasingly, the corrupt and scandalous life of the high clergy is drawing sharp criticism from both the middle and the lower classes. Add to all of this problems with faith, the Black Death between 1348 and 1350. How can the church possibly explain this calamity, this catastrophe of unimagined proportions? We also have the Hundred Years' War going on between 1330 and 1453. It should be the 123 Years' War, but that's hard on the tongue, so let's just stick with 100. Urban discontent and peasant unrest spread across Europe. Add to this increasingly powerful secular monarchs who fill the vacuum created by the church's administrative and spiritual problems. This is a time of great change, of great danger, of great turmoil, where the old world slowly but inexorably moves to become the modern world. What's the impact of all of this on music? Well, there's an explosion of secular musical composition. And not just love songs like the Ventadorn we just heard. Oh, no. But complex and often hauntingly beautiful compositions. In these religiously troubled times, secular musical art becomes high musical art for the first time, at least the first time since the world of ancient Greece. Indeed, much of the music composed during the mid to late 14th century exhibits a complexity, I mean a structural complexity, in terms of melodic and harmonic schemes and formulas that will not be equaled again until the 1950s. This music well mirrors a complex and difficult world, a world in transition from being dominated by the absolute authority of the church and its immutable doctrines to a new world of increasing secularity, humanistic pursuit, and, for better or for worse, doubt. The great composer of the mid-14th century is a gentleman named Guillaume de Machaut, who was born about 1300 and died, for sure, in 1377. His elegant, spiky, incredibly complex music is utterly representative of this complicated and difficult time. We're going to listen to a piece by Machaut, and Machaut is the second of those Parisian-based composers I told you we would listen to. We listened to Leonin from the 12th century, and now we listen to Machaut, also based at Notre Dame, from the 14th century. In this secular work, Machaut is both composer and poet. By the way, he was considered as great a poet as he was considered a composer. Here are the words to Rose Lees, circa 1350. Rose, lily, spring greenery, flower balm, and the sweetest fragrance, beautiful lady, you surpass them all in sweetness. And all the gifts of nature you possess, for which I adore you, rose, lily, spring, greenery, flower, balm, and the sweetest fragrance. And since beyond all creatures your virtue excels, I can honestly say, rose, lily, spring, greenery, flower, balm, and very sweet fragrance, beautiful lady, you surpass them all in sweetness. It's a very attractive poem, actually, even in translation. It's very attractive and very romantic, and I would tell you that this is music of extraordinary and haunting beauty, but also daunting complexity. Now, clearly, I'm not going to explain the melodic and rhythmic schemes. There's no time. You'll hear a certain spikiness to the music, and this has to do with the formulas. But you'll also hear a composer at the top of his game who can create great lyricism and great beauty, even given these formulas that he's wont to use. Please, let me play this for you, and I would ask you to ask yourselves that key question. What is expressive in this music? Guillaume de Machaut, Rose Lees. So, what is expressive in this extraordinary music? many things. It's lyrically very beautiful, and I trust any number of you, especially those who've sung in choruses, have some sense of how hard this must be to perform in a small, unaccompanied vocal ensemble like that. These are extraordinarily virtuosic singers. It's extremely virtuosic music, very foreign sounding to our ears because the harmonic system we are accustomed to has not evolved yet, and I'm going to talk about that in about 5 minutes. But perhaps what this is most expressive of, might I suggest, is control. Control. Control of emotions, charmingly stated, and control of the complex musical means and the interweaving polyphonic lines and schemes that are intrinsic to this musical style. Perhaps the composers of the mid-14th century were attempting to assert on their art the one thing that no one seemed to be able to assert on their environment, and that was a sense of rational control in a world at that time, perhaps rootless and out of control. The secularism of the 14th century, the loss of faith represented in the 14th century, the loss of authority, of absolute authority, of the Roman Church in the 14th century, leads inevitably to the Renaissance in the 15th century. The musical Renaissance, as we understand it, goes from about 1400 to 1600. The experience of rediscovering ancient Greek and Roman culture overwhelmed Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries. It could not help affecting the way people thought about music. To be sure, it wasn't possible for Renaissance men and women to hear actual ancient Greek music. None of it had been translated and interpreted yet. But a rethinking of music's purpose in light of what could be read in the writings of ancient philosophers, poets, essayists, and music theories was not only possible, but some believed urgently required. Those who read ancient literature asked themselves why their modern music did not move people to the various passions the way ancient music was said to have done for the ancients themselves. For example, Bernardino Cirillo wrote this, quote, "Music among the ancients was the most splendid of all the fine arts. With it, they created powerful effects that nowadays we cannot produce. Thus, the musicians of today should endeavor in their profession to do what the sculptors, painters, and architects of our time have done, who have recovered the art of the ancients." During the Renaissance, then, artists, architects, poets, dramatists, philosophers, and composers turned to pre-Christian models for inspiration and guidance, and preeminent among those models are the models supplied by the ancient Greek world. Now, of course, the impact on music is going to be just tremendous, just huge, and just profound. Composers of both religious and secular music, and they are usually the same person, want to capture for their music the same power of expression the Greeks ascribed to their music. The question is, of course, how? How do we do that? Well, there are two general solutions that Renaissance composers increasingly turn to make their music more expressive and to try to achieve this Greek ideal of moving the souls of people and changing the face of nature. Solution number one had to do with articulation of the words. Renaissance composers believed firmly that since the message of any piece of music was in the words, clear articulation of words was of preeminent importance. Now, much as I love the Machaut, Rose Lees, frankly, clear articulation of the words is of secondary importance. The rhythmic and the melodic schemes are of more importance. And so if you land on a syllable that's supposed to be accented in language, but in the music it's in an inconvenient place to accent, Machaut will not accent it. Because the musical scheme comes first, vocal articulation and clarity comes second. We're talking about the flip now, that the composers of the Renaissance, first and foremost, want their words to be heard clearly. If the meaning of the music lies in the words, the meaning of the words must be clear. Solution number two, word painting. The images and feelings described by these words must somehow be illustrated by the music. So whatever the music is doing, it must portray and illustrate what the words are saying. And what that means we'll get into in just a moment. Now listen, importantly, by the mid-Renaissance, by around 1500, an entirely new harmonic system was evolving. based on new examinations of the work of Pythagoras and other ancient Greek theorists. I'm just going to illustrate a couple of points as quickly as I can, and then we'll move on. But this evolution of what we call functional harmony has a huge impact on the future of music. I'm going to take a melody, and this is a melody that we will hear in a vocal piece in just another minute or so, and I'm just going to take the very beginning of this vocal piece. And first I'm going to play this melody monophonically, unaccompanied, one melody, one voice. Not terribly engaging, but that's what we would sing if we were singing monophony, one melody and one melody only. Now I'm going to play it polyphonically in one of the most common sorts of polyphony, what we call imitative polyphony, where one voice imitates another. Now, what happens during the Renaissance with this new investigation into Pythagoras and the overtone series is the concept of chord evolves. That is, the sounding of three or more simultaneously different pitches. How do we coordinate these chords? How do we create laws by which these simultaneities can shift back and forth? I will now harmonize that silly little line using Renaissance-style harmonies. Now, this sounds much more modern to our ears. This is also a texture, and here's the important point. If this was monophony, and this was polyphony, then this we call homophony, because there's one main melody and all else is accompaniment. We can juice those harmonies up, and believe me, the history of music from 1500 to 1900 is to a great degree about juicing up the chords. For example, now, if George Gershwin or Duke Ellington or Claude Debussy was playing this, they might do something like this. These harmonies get bigger and thicker with more and more added notes all the time. The point is, we have the first composed homophony, basically chordal music, in the Renaissance. Look, I'm going to jump ahead of myself and just make sure we all know why this is so important. Opera is a homophonic phenomena. One voice, everything else perceived as accompanimental to support that voice. Until we have homophony, until we have the means to quietly and convincingly accompany one main melody, we cannot expect the operatic ideal of one person singing about how they feel to evolve. So the advent of homophony is the last of the three textures, first monophony, then polyphony, and then homophony. It is a product of the reinvestigation of Greek theory that we see during the Renaissance. The upshot of all of this is as follows. The music we're about to hear sounds quite comfortable, quite modern to our ears, as opposed to the spiky, more foreign-sounding music of Machaut, written 100 years before what we're about to hear. What we're about to hear was written by Josquin des Prez, born about 1450, died 1521. Josquin is the preeminent composer of the mid-Renaissance, and one of my absolute favorites. I don't mind saying that forever on the media. He is a master of both sacred and secular music. We're going to listen to two of Josquin's shorter vocal works as examples of mid-Renaissance vocal articulation, mid-Renaissance word painting, and mid-Renaissance harmonic practice. First, we're going to listen to a cute little ditty called El Grillo, the cricket. Oh, written around 1480, as best as we can tell. It's written in Italian, And it is an essentially homophonic work, depending on these block-like chords. And it was the beginning of El Grillo that I was using just now in my textural demonstration. What will be word-painted, of course, is the jumpy nature of the music. Please, let's read the text first. The cricket is a good singer who holds a long note. Go ahead, drink and sing, cricket, but he is not like the other birds, who sing a little and then fly away. The cricket always stands firm. When it is hottest, he sings alone for love. So the way this piece will be painted, the way Josquin will make sure that we know this is about a cricket, is with the jumpy, almost hyperkinetic rhythms that we will hear, very clearly creating a kind of insectile texture. I would also point out that the articulation is crystal clear. He serves the words. We can follow every word with utter clarity. The harmony sounds modern. The piece is altogether humorous and engaging. A hugely far cry from the very foreign, if attractive-sounding music we heard from Machaut 100 years before. Josquin, El Grillo. As I said before, this is very modern-sounding music. Clearly, it wasn't written yesterday, but clearly it uses a language with which we are all familiar and comfortable. And I didn't even point out this lovely bit of word painting. How can Josquin, and by the way, I keep calling him Josquin, because that's as he was known, and if you go to search for him in the CD bins of your local store, he will not be under Dupré. He will be under Josquin, unless the person who's filing the music has not a clue of what they should call him, and then who knows where it will be. In any case, Josquin has in the text here, who holds a long note. Now, what composer could possibly resist writing a long note when they're singing longo verso? So he doesn't resist. But that's an example of word painting, and that's the kind of phenomena we see first in the Renaissance. What is this music expressive of? Well, it's expressive of a wonderfully clever and humorous poem. The jumpy spirit of the cricket comes through loud and clear. Let's listen to another brief work by Josquin, which illustrates another part of his art and another aspect of mid-Renaissance music. This is a piece called Je me complains. I complain. Well, there's something we all could use here and there. This, rather than Italian poetry, is French poetry. And please understand that at this time, composers needed to go back and forth easily between Italian and French poetry. Josquin himself was from north of France, perhaps from Belgium, but probably he was from the north of France. And he split his career between the rich French courts and the even richer courts on the Italian peninsula during the Renaissance, of course, gathering tremendous wealth through trade. So this is a chanson as opposed to the frottola or the homophonic Italian work we heard before. What makes this work really different is that it is polyphonic. We have five voices, and they're all interweaving within each other all the time. Now, each part in this five-voice polyphony we were about to hear, if you look at each part, you would see the declamation, the clarity of the words is absolute. But of course, when you stick those five parts together and they start swimming together like strands of spaghetti, the words might not be so clear anymore because everyone's singing their own words at any given time. If we were to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat as a group, we would have no problem if we're all singing the same melody at the same time hearing the words. But, of course, when we sing it as a round and start overlapping, then it's harder to perceive individual words because at any given moment we're hearing three different words. So it is with polyphony. Even if the articulation of our individual lines is crystal clear in a polyphonic texture, when you combine all of these individual lines, clarity suffers. So this will be a different kind of piece, and it will evoke a different expressive content. The text: I complain about my friend who usually comes to see me in the early morning, but now it's mid-morning, and now it's afternoon, and I don't have news of him. Evening prayers, vespers, will soon be approaching. The knitting, the lovely knitting girl. All right, she's sitting there waiting for her boy to come, and he has not come. And she knits, and she knits, and she sorrows, quietly, but she sorrows. This is her complaint. Please let me play this for you, and I would ask you once again, what is this music expressive of? What is it reflective of? So what is this music reflective, expressive of? I would point out that the rhythms are not those jumpy, kinetic rhythms that we heard in El Grillo. Rather, this is a kind of languid and flowing music, basically dark in what we call the minor mode. It's a kind of generalized mood, I think, one of romantic malaise. It's not a pointed mood. We don't have one person telling us how badly she feels, but there's a mood, a sensibility, an environment, if you will, that just Scant creates that's very lovely and very convincing at the soul of these words is that malaise, that unhappiness. Now we move to the late Renaissance, to the madrigal. The madrigal was the most important genre of Italian secular music in the late Renaissance. In part, I would tell you that it is the rejection of the madrigal that led directly to the invention of opera. Madrigals were works for vocal ensemble of typically 4 to 6 different singers. They freely mixed polyphony and homophony. So if we mixed together El Grillo and Je Me Complains, that is a little homophony, a little polyphony, we would get what might happen in a single madrigal. Madrigals were based, and this is what sets them apart from much of the vocal music around them, madrigals were based on serious, elevated poetry by serious poets. Increasingly, there's a feeling, even in this secular music of the Renaissance, that a higher level of poetry could bring about a higher level of music expression. And so madrigals are set to the poems of Petrarch, Ariosto, Tasso, and their like. Madrigals, like the two pieces we just heard, are expressive via word painting, illustrating the literal meaning of the words. But I would tell you that madrigals take this word painting to a sometimes excessive end. Now, madrigals would be performed in all sorts of social and courtly gatherings. And I would also tell you that the output of madrigals in Italy was enormous. And these were popular all across Europe, not just in Italy. But in Italy alone, some 2,000 collections of madrigals were published between 1530 and 1600. Now, the madrigal I'm going to use as an example is one of my favorites. It's by Thomas Weelkes, who's an Englishman. And this is As Vesta Was from Latmos Hill Descending, from 1601. And the reason why I love this madrigal is because it is in English. It's easier for us to follow the amusing word painting that Weelkes indulges in. It is a light, brilliant, and airy madrigal of great humor. Now, I would tell you that Weelkes wrote this madrigal for an anthology called The Triumphs of Oriana. 23 different English composers contributed madrigals to this collection. And while each of these madrigals had a different poem, they all had the same last two lines. Then sang the shepherds and nymphs of Diana, long live fair Oriana. So all 23 of these madrigals ended with those same two lines. Oriana was the mythological name for Queen Elizabeth, then near the very end of her reign. And the nymphs and shepherds of Diana, the goddess of virginity, were her subjects. Now, in this particular poem, another goddess, Vesta, is walking down her hill in Rome, accompanied by Diana's little androgynous darlings, the Vestal Virgins, who nevertheless desert Vesta, leave her in the dust as soon as they get light of Oriana, Queen Elizabeth, a real virgin, walking up the hill. So here's what we get, and you'll excuse me for illustrating with my voice those things we'll hear Weelkes do in the poem. As Vesta was from Latmos Hill, from Latmos Hill, from Latmos Hill, high note on hill, descending, descending, she spied a maiden queen the same time, ascending, ascending, attended on by all the shepherd swain, to whom Diana's darling came running down a main, running down a, running down a, running down a main, running down a main, over and over and over. First, 2 by 2, sung by 2 singers, then 3 by 3, sung by 3 singers, then together, sung by everyone, leaving their goddess all alone, sung by 1 singer. Hasted thither, and mingling with the shepherds of her train with mirthful tunes, her presence did entertain. Then sang the shepherds and nymphs of Diana, long live fair Oriana. And as the men at the bottom of this group sing long, they just hold the word long. It's very cute. It's very brilliant. It's a perfect example of a late Renaissance madrigal where the word painting is taken to extreme degrees.
Say, 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 say